Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the CFR Academic Conference Call Series. I'm Maria Casa, Director for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Thank you all for joining us. Today's call is on the record, and the audio file will be posted on our website, cfr.org, if you would like to share it with colleagues or classmates. We are delighted to have Blake Clayton here with us today to discuss energy dependence. Blake Clayton is CFR's Fellow for Energy and National Security. Dr. Clayton joined CFR from Lewis Capital Markets, where he was a senior commodities analyst and head of oil research. He was a special assistant to the late Matthew R. Simmons, founder and chairman emeritus of Simmons & Company International, with whom he worked on launching Ocean Energy Group, a venture capital firm and think tank focused on early-stage energy innovation. Dr. Clayton is a member of the Center for National Policy's Energy Security Working Policy Group and was previously a researcher at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. Welcome, Blake, and thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Maria, and thank you all for dialing in. I'm delighted to join you and to have this opportunity to talk about a subject I think is both timely and one that will, you know, be taking up an increasing amount of news media coverage in the coming months.
Let me just start out by asking you, energy policy continues to be a subject of heated debate. Perhaps you could begin by providing us with an overview of the current state of energy supply in the world and the most important controversies surrounding it.
Sure. Well, let me start off by saying that I think the way you have to understand global energy supply and demand today is in the context of a global population that is increasing very quickly. Official estimates put global population growth at 1.7 billion people over the next two decades, and combined with that is the fact that the global economy will be growing. And that means, very simply, that demand for energy on a worldwide basis will be growing for the foreseeable future. And the world will need to pull on a variety of energy sources in order to meet that burgeoning demand. Now, all energy sources are not created equal, and different sources will factor into the mix, some to a much larger degree than others. I think the reality of where the world gets its energy supply today might surprise a lot of you, since it really drives home the point that I think a couple of things. One is that the United States and Europe are no longer at the center of the global energy equation today in the same way that they were even a decade ago, let alone, 50 years ago. To get a feel for the dynamics underlying some of these global energy trends, I think it's helpful to break down the issue into two of the major uses of energy. One of those would be power generation, and the other would be transportation. In terms of transportation, today, oil meets about 94% of worldwide demand. Renewable sources have yet to penetrate that sector in a very significant way. Oil demand will continue to grow, with the net increase coming from transportation in the emerging economies, as economic growth there pushes up demand for personal mobility and also for commercial uses like freight. The number of passenger cars, just to give you a sense of the scale, the number of passenger cars on the planet may double within 20 years to 1.7 billion. So there are a lot of people who are going to be hitting the road, and energy will need to be able to meet that need. There's a lot of talk about renewable energy, but hydrocarbon-based energy like oil, gas, and coal are still poised to be the dominant source of energy in the coming decades. Let me give you a few statistics from the IEA that it sees as, where it sees global energy coming from for the until 2035. The IEA, which is the International Energy Agency, sees the share of coal, oil, and natural gas in the global energy mix falling slightly, just slightly, though, from 81% to 75% between now and 2035. With renewable energy, that's mainly hydropower and wind, in their view, starting to fill a greater share of power generation. Official estimates expect that in the power sector, renewable energy technologies will account for half of all of the new capacity installed over the coming two decades. But remember that coal, natural gas, and oil alone still account for almost 70% of world electricity generation today. Coal by itself provides almost 50% of global power generation needs, and coal also accounted for nearly half of the increase in global energy use over the past decade. So I think many of us in the United States and Europe, too, are used to seeing coal as kind of yesterday's news when it comes to where the world gets its energy, but nothing could be further from the truth. That's, of course, you know, it may be true that coal is losing market share in the OECD, but you have to remember that these emerging economies like China and India are playing a much larger role in global energy demand trends than they used to.
Great. Thanks for the introduction, Blake. Let's turn it over to the participants for their questions now.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we would like to open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, please press star 2. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone now. Our first question will come from Chris Fitzpatrick, Duke University.
Hello. We've got a group of students here at Duke in Professor Stephen Kelly's class. Hello from Stephen Kelly, who's not here today. But I had a question about the potential role of shale gas in displacing some of the coal growth that you spoke about in emerging economies. We know a little bit about shale formations in China and India and some other developing markets, and just wondered if you could address the possibility of that resource possibly displacing some of the coal generation moving forward.
It's a great question, and it's a big topic. Let me back up just a step or two to talk about some of the developments in shale gas and shale oil to give people a context for some of the kind of broader historical and economic forces that play into my answer to that question. As many of you are aware, shale gas refers to basically a combination of two technologies, horizontal drilling and what they call hydraulic fracturing, which oil and gas producers, especially United States, North America, but in some places around the world, have been deploying to very large effect. They've been able to use these new technologies over the last a few years to extract vast amounts of natural gas at a scale that really people had not even dreamed of even a decade ago. The result of that has been is most visible here in the United States, where natural gas prices have fallen to their lowest levels in a decade, based simply on the fact that production is way up from these new technologies and the shale gas, even as demand has been rather mild due to the mild winter. So you have a North American gas market that's more or less glutted. The United States is swimming in natural gas. And that's made people wonder, well, hey, since, for example, the United States, an awful lot of our power generation comes from coal-fired plants and natural gas-fired plants, is there a way that, is it possible or probable that some of the power that's currently generated by coal will switch over to natural gas? Of course, many of the plants that are being used today can use either source, and they choose whether they're going to use coal or gas based on how expensive those two sources are. So anyway, to answer your question, I think it's a good one. It's certainly the right question to be asking. You mentioned the prospects for shale gas in China and other places, and I think that's an important thing to be keeping in mind. I spoke with EIA officials recently who told me that what we know about the shale gas resource outside the United States, and to some extent even inside the United States, is still very preliminary, still very tentative. So I think we have to be careful. By we, I mean energy analysts. I have to be careful when we jump to conclusions about what the size of our resource base will be here in the United States, let alone in places like China, where we simply don't have as high quality of data as we'd like. And the reason that matters is simply because that will affect, the price that, for example, the Chinese power generators will be able to access gas at, and so how competitive gas is on a cost basis with coal. My sense is that I'm tremendously optimistic about what shale gas can mean, not just here in the United States in terms of natural gas increasing share in the energy mix, but also for China. One thing you might be interested in, I don't know if you saw the IEA's World Energy Outlook they published a few months ago, but natural gas was actually the only hydrocarbon energy source that they saw increasing in market share over the next two decades. I don't want to get too far into the weeds in terms of some of the technical issues that arise in the kind of coal to gas switching equation. But I am optimistic that given the right profit motive, and certainly it's there in North America right now, that power generators will, just by virtue of market forces, increasingly lean on natural gas as opposed to coal, even outside the United States.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Next question will come from Virginia Tech.
Hi, you talked about how population is going to increase over the next two decades by about 1.7 billion, and a lot of statistics say that urbanization is going to increase tremendously in that time. Do you feel that as with such levels of growth and such inevitable pretty much scarcity of resource, do you feel that energy regulation is going to get to the point of energy securitization in terms of population density and such other such factors?
When you say energy securitization, are you talking about finance? Are you talking about increasing energy security, or securitization in the sense of it being traded as a financial security?
I suppose more the sense of increased controls, extreme regulation.
Yeah. I'm not sure I totally understand the question, but I think my sense is, let me offer a couple thoughts. One is that certainly the sources of energy that urban consumers tend to draw on are different from what rural consumers use, especially in emerging economies. And that's for a couple of reasons. One is that it tends to be more tightly regulated in the city. Another is that those in the city tend to have access to both infrastructure and also consumer spending ability in a way that those outside urban centers may not. And so it affects the type of energy they consume. It also affects the quantity of energy they consume. And when you have people coming on the grid, for example, in a massive way in the emerging economies, you're going to see some switching and, the kinds of energy sources that people are drawing on, from biofuels, for example, to stuff that requires greater infrastructure, like piped natural gas or even LNG. You're going to see more people coming on to kind of mainstream electricity grids that maybe use nuclear or coal-fired plants. You're also going to see the amount of electricity use in the world increase by leaps and bounds. I think along with those two kind of market pressures, regulators will, I think you'll see, increasingly need to respond to the challenge of urban energy use. And that will come in a couple forms. I'm sure tighter regulations over which sources of energy they use for authorized for transportation, for electricity generation. They'll take into account pollution in cities, technical feasibility, those sorts of things. And you'll also see, and this is a point I tried to mention in my opening remarks, you'll see that growth in consumer spending in the form of, buying cars and buying other industrial and kind of commercial appliances and residential appliances that are more energy intensive than what poor people in rural parts of the world tend to have access to.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Next question will come from Webster University.
Yes, you mentioned the increase in cars. I believe 1.7 billion was the number used. What do you see as the next fuel alternative, if any? I mean, a renewed push for ethanol, perhaps, like E85 or something else?
It's a great question. There's a lot of, obviously, public interest in and commercial interest in new kind of in transportation fuels other than oil. There's a simple reason for that. One is that oil is very expensive. If you look at a oil versus natural gas on a energy content basis, you'll see that oil, at least in the United States, is much, much more expensive than natural gas. So understandably, commercial players are eager to draw on some of these more affordable energy sources like natural gas and try to find a way to incorporate them into the transportation demand mix. There are many different fuels that are being talked about. You mentioned ethanol, which is one and is being used to a greater extent in some parts of the world than others. People think of Brazil. It's also making a meaningful difference. Here in the United States, it's a very small share of the market, but still does turn the dial to some extent. And if you look at the way that gasoline demand in the United States has more or less dropped off a cliff and then plateaued in starting in 2005, 6, 7, a part of that is due to the growth of ethanol requirements, which has played into the amount of refined products that the U.S. ships abroad. There are other, energy sources being considered, like gas to liquids and methane-based stuff. I don't think we have time to get too much into the details of all those, but I'd certainly be happy to answer any questions you had or point you to some good resources on those subjects at another time.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Thank you. Once again, as a quick reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone now. Our next question will come from Ohio State University.
Hi. We had a question about the environmental aspect of the increasing demand, particularly things like fracking and how the negative aspects of those processes have been pretty well, I guess, publicized, and how that will affect the future of the planet in general.
It's a great question. Fracking is an issue that, as you know, has generated a lot of controversy here in the United States. I think increasingly it will in Europe as some of these methods spread in that part of the world. I think my sense is that most objections to fracking come, I would say most credible objections to fracking at least come in along two lines. One is not what you think of, but it's actually wastewater disposal. Fracking is incredibly, incredibly water intensive because it relies on pumping water at very high pressure down into these pipes as a means of basically extracting gas and oil, and not just water, but also chemicals and sand and other substances. So what you have the issue you have come up is basically what to do with that water when it you remove it from the ground. You remove it from the pipe. What you tend to see, if you've ever looked at pictures of a rig, let's say, in one of these shale plays like the Marcellus in the United States that's drilling for shale oil or gas, is a pretty good-sized wastewater kind of pond next to the drilling rig. And it can cause all sorts of environmental problems, and oil companies and regulators are trying to figure out how to mitigate those. So I think that's one issue that you're not hearing too much about because it's not very flashy, but it's very important from a regulatory point of view. I think another issue that people in the actual drilling regions feel very strongly about and is generating a lot of buzz in the press is simply the fact that a lot of these very small towns or rural areas, let's say in Pennsylvania or in North Dakota or parts of Texas, are not used to, we're never really hubs of drilling activity. And so they see this, massive inflow of people and gigantic trucks and drilling equipment, all sorts of things being hauled at all hours of the night and drilling activity happening 24/7. And it's a real social disruption to the fabric of some of these pretty small towns, to be honest. And so it creates kind of a disruption to people's lives in a way that is I think, wasn't foreseen and will require some amount of regulation. I actually think those are two areas where wastewater disposal and also kind of these social issues in the drilling regions that are, in my mind, two of the most important that regulators get right. And as I see it, you may think of oil and gas companies as naturally kind of, disincentivized to correct whatever problems people perceive in fracking. But I think the truth is just the opposite. These companies are going to need access to acreage, and to some extent that's going to, they're going to need federal and state officials to give them the thumbs up, give them the go-ahead to drill and to put another infrastructure like pipelines. And so it's actually in their best interest to, play by the rules and also help regulators, work with regulators to put good rules in place and then abide by them so that regulation, restrictive regulations don't get in the way, or let's say overly restrictive regulations don't get in the way of, I think, in my mind, all the economic good that can be done from increasing more oil and gas in the United States.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question will come from San Diego State University.
Hi, my name is Brian. I'm a student at San Diego State. And my question is regarding what you were just talking about, fracking and shale. I once heard Al Gore make a comment that fracking and shale is sort of like a junkie who can't use the veins in his arms anymore and uses it in his toes now. And can you talk about our addiction to fossil fuels? And I've seen a lot of comments about speculators, and are they helping to supply our addiction to fossil fuels, and will we be able to get over that and meet our goals to reduce our fossil fuel usage? And are there possibilities in switchgrass, LG, and the use of battery power?
Great, thanks. Yeah, it's a big question, I think, with a lot of different components. Let me focus primarily on the question of energy independence. And I'm going to do that from the perspective of the United States, which is really seeing a transformation in its degree of dependence on imported oil to an extent that, again, you know, people just did not see coming, but has completely transformed the way that the United States produces and consumes oil, and also what the outlook is for its, as you put it, addiction in the future. I'm always a little hesitant to use the term oil addiction in the sense that I think it can be kind of an emotionally charged term. We trade a lot of things, a lot of products. We're dependent on oil, but we're also very dependent on other products. Now, don't get me wrong. The oil trade and oil production and other aspects of the oil industry can, are problematic. But what's actually interesting to me right now is that for all of the talk just a few years ago that renewable energy looked like the only way out of the only way to really give the United States energy security, what you're seeing right now is that market forces here in the United States have actually pushed net oil imports much lower than they were only a couple of years ago, and that trend looks poised to continue. Every president, really, since Richard Nixon has called for energy independence, notwithstanding U.S. reliance on imported oil, for a long time seemed to only be going in that in one direction, and that was up. And that pointed really to increasing dependence on the resources of the Middle East. But what you've seen over the last few years is U.S. petroleum imports on a net basis peaked in 2005, and they've been going in the other direction. They're now at about 45%. Part of what's been going on is demand. Oil consumption reached what you might call peak demand in the United States in 2005. That's partly due to increased efficiencies and also demand, consumer behavior. But also, there have been impressive developments on the supply side. U.S. crude oil input has risen by 20% since 2008. Part of that's come from deep water drilling, but a lot of it's come from this shale oil. And natural gas liquids that are being produced in increasing quantities. In 2000, only about 200,000 barrels per day of tight oil was produced in the United States, but some credible private sector estimates put that figure at as much as 3 million barrels a day. That would mean over half of current domestic oil production. By 2020 or so. And so what you're going to see is this increasing reliance on imported oil in the United States. It's actually really fascinating. Did you know last year in 2011, the single biggest export from the United States in terms of value was fuel, was, you know, gasoline, diesel, jet fuel, that type of thing, oil-based fuels. There are a few reasons behind that trend, but it, you know, those exports brought in about $80 billion last year. That's because we're producing more at home. We're consuming less. And so refiners, especially along the Gulf Coast in the southern United States, are sending more oil products, refined products away. So certainly the landscape, the American kind of oil addiction and energy security landscape is shifting in a very major way, and I think that's a trend you should keep your eye on in the coming years.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Duke University. Duke, go ahead.
Oh, hi. My name is Barry Butler. I'm a student at Duke, and just had a question. We haven't talked about the Keystone XL pipeline. And just curious, I mean, it seems as though we're going to go ahead and approve it in the end. And once that comes on board fully, the only refineries that can actually refine the oil sands from Canada are down on the Gulf Coast. Do you foresee that the United States will be able to handle the extra capacity with the existing refineries, or that we will have to build additional refineries to meet that demand?
Yeah, it's a great question. Keystone XL was really the hot energy topic of a couple months ago. As many of you, I'm sure, know, that Keystone XL is the pipeline that was proposed to be built basically from Alberta, Canada, stretching all the way down to the Gulf Coast. It was due to be reviewed, and ultimately I think most people expected to be approved by the State Department last year, when basically the Obama administration stepped in and put it kind of on indefinite hold for their own reasons. I was surprised by that decision. Now, there are many Republicans who say that it, you know, that decision played a meaningful role in why gas prices are so high right now. That simply is not the case. And yet, in my mind, the merits of approving Keystone XL outweighed any arguments for not approving it. But I know that there are many who have very strong opinions on that front. And I agree with you that ultimately Keystone XL or something, you know, very similar to it will be approved. But I think it's an issue that probably will not be resolved until after the presidential election. I think it's just simply too hot an issue for the Obama administration to want to wade into it right now. But I would expect them to approve it in some form. I think they've already signaled that they will do that. And I would guess the timing would be, you know, again, after the election. I also think were Romney or someone else elected, that they would approve it right away. So, but to answer your question about refining capacity, yeah, I mean, as you know, the refining capacity on the Gulf of Mexico is among the most technologically advanced and flexible in the world, flexible in the sense that it can process a wide variety of oil. Obviously, many refineries can process light, sweet crude, and other easy-to-refine crudes, but the problem comes when you start getting heavier stuff and more sour stuff. And that's, of course, part of what you're going to be seeing from Canada. Now, some of the oil sand stuff in Canada, the really heavy stuff, as you know, is actually has to be processed to some extent right there in Canada before it's put in pipelines because it's that heavy. But certainly the energy mix in the United States is becoming, partly as a result of the Canadian production factor, is becoming heavier and more sour, and refineries along the coast, Gulf Coast, are going to need to account for that. My sense is that right now they're fairly well equipped, but certainly the good forecasts that I see predict that if emerging market economies like Brazil, who are poised to increase their own oil production in the years ahead, do not start building more refineries of their own domestically, then the Gulf Coast and other areas in the United States will take on an increasing quantity of that job. And, yeah, I think the United States would be increasing its refining capacity in order to meet that challenge.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Our next question will come from St. Edwards Kamitsky.
In regards to transportation, where should we go besides fuel alternatives? Because we can always go electric, but all that electricity has to come from somewhere. So in regards to transportation, so if every source has to come from somewhere and be produced, and it's going to have such a large influence on the environment and the economy, should we continue to look for different fuel sources or just better uses of the sources we already have?
It's a great question. I mean, I think anyone who looks at the numbers seriously and looks at what's happening in the emerging world sees, like you have, that it's going to be very tricky to meet future global energy demand growth on renewables alone, even though it would be nice if that were the case. I think that one thing to look at would be energy efficiency. I think people tend to look a lot at supply and demand, but might overlook the role that efficiency really can play in helping create a more sustainable energy economy. And I think President Obama, to his credit, has done a good job with his call for increasing the CAFE standards to help continue to have American cars meet certain efficiency standards that have already been shown to have huge effects on how much oil, especially gasoline, we consume here in the United States. So I think that were other countries to adopt similarly rigorous efficiency standards and buy technologies that were based on those standards, you'd see that would have a really beneficial effect on global kind of environmental and energy economics.
Thank you, Blake. Next question, please.
Our next question will come from University of Houston.
Hi. You mentioned that it was an uphill battle to move towards green energy and efficient energy. What would the government, realistically speaking, have to do through regulations and financial incentives to get companies to do this? And would the government even see any point to doing it, especially towards green energy, due to the possible repercussions and consequences that the citizens and companies would face because of that move?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that there are a couple parts to that question. One is that, in my mind, I think the number one kind of factor in when consumers will adopt cleaner energy, especially renewable energy, is cost parity. So when they're able to buy, a car that runs on X renewable source, then as opposed to oil, they'll gladly buy it. Now, that's not rocket science. That's not news to anybody. But ultimately, I think that it's that very simple kind of market equation that will play the deciding factor in, from a consumer standpoint, people really start to adopt renewable energy at scale. One thing that you have happen, though, is that many times it's hard for those who would like to innovate and commercialize in renewable energy to do so because capital costs are so high. In other words, it costs so much money to build a good prototype or build a new type of power plant or whatever it is that it's hard to raise that money without government help of some kind and prove its commercial viability, its competitiveness. I think that's a problem that the United States kind of government at the federal level is trying to address, but it's a hard one. There are some people who call for taxes on what they see as less desirable fuels, like oil, or other ways of artificially inflating the price of oil and coal and other dirtier substances in order to encourage renewable energy. So I think that's one way you do it, whether that's through carbon credits or through carbon tax or whatever it is. I think you can do it that way. But, it's funny, you're calling from the University of Houston. I actually think that some really, really exciting things are going on in terms of natural gas production, even oil production right here in the United States, I think that federal policymakers should be paying a lot of attention to. So I guess my only kind of comment in closing would be, yes, certainly renewables, but I would also think hard about ways to maximize hydrocarbon-based sources to their fullest, to really, really run with some of these promising trends for North American energy security that have been starting to develop over the last couple of years.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Our next question will come from Virginia Tech.
So, obviously, energy production and consumption is tied to energy emissions, and we haven't talked much about the Kyoto Accords or the previous summit in Durban, but what I'm curious about is if we are to continue to maximize all resources as far as coal, as far as oil or the shale or fracking or whatever, how can it be possible to lower emission standards to an extent that would be acceptable in the international community?
Yeah. Well, I think that the answer to that question in part is going to be based on where you're sitting. So it's a very different the kind of policy climate with regards to climate change is very different, as you know, in Europe or some parts of Asia than it is here in the United States. So I think that, and I know that climate specialists, which I'm really not, have sensed a very strong kind of pullback from policymakers with regard to their willingness to take seriously and put in place measures that would help curb the problem of climate change. I think that what you see now is rather than the kind of, or to some extent, the kind of globally, global orchestration or coordination on climate issues, you see countries, especially the United States, more than ever kind of, going its own way. Now, of course, it's never been as, willing to undertake kind of painful measures in order to go the climate route that the Europeans and others have. But I think it's an issue. I guess the bottom line is that it's really in flux right now. And I think that it will be interesting with regards to this next presidential election to see who the winner is and how that, I think, might impact the conversation here in the United States about climate change and emission standards and those types of things in the next few years.
Right. Well, you spoke about painful measures. I think that the upwards of a million people employed in Germany's green energy sector wouldn't say that supporting that these sort of things would be that painful. I guess my question is it painful for who? Because in, like you said, the fracking communities that are getting, they're not only they're socially disrupted as you brought up, but increasingly, water supplies are being poisoned. Fracking has been tied to issues with earthquakes and this sort of thing. So, for whom is the process of transferring to renewable energies painful?
Well, I think what I believe I said or was trying to say was that the policymakers are less willing to undertake painful measures now than they have in the past, and I think that's a fact. If you look at the kind of the global narrative when it comes to climate change, and if that's here in the United States or elsewhere, you'll see that there's simply less willingness to undertake what policymakers perceive as being, measures that would hurt some constituency. Now, it's an impossible question to answer in a sense because there are so many different constituencies that we have to talk about to really dig into that question, whether it's the policymaker's own re-election prospects or whether it's one industry or another, the oil industry in the United States, the renewable industry in the United States. Remember, the new renewable industry has many subcomponents. And that's not even to get into nuclear or some of these other sources. So it's a very big question, but and it, you know, I can tell from your question that it's one obviously that people have very strong opinions about and feel heated about. But you know, I think if you you know, if your understanding is that in order to move to renewables and really embrace that economy wouldn't require any downside, then I'd say you're not looking at some of the realities of energy supply and demand. Now, don't get me wrong. I think the case could be made that there is, you know, that the pros outweighs the cons to taking on some of these energy sources in a larger way. But I still think it's, you know, despite whatever Germany is doing in terms of job creation and renewables, I think really moving the clean energy agenda forward means taking a hard look and a realistic look at the pros and cons of any energy source, which there are, in my mind, with any one of them.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Seneca College.
Hi, it's Gary Johnson from Seneca in Toronto, Canada. Given that over the next 20 years, we're looking at 94% of the net increase in oil demand coming from China and India. Currently, we have, I think, about 97% of the oil that we produce is exported south. And I think in total, we are, I think we're number one on the list. We probably match the combined total of the Saudi and Mexican oil that's coming in, as well as about a third of the uranium that you're using in the nuclear reactors. So my question, I'm really interested, I guess, in the U.S. perspective on these issues. We've recently made the statement that because of the delays around the XL pipeline, that we're actively pursuing the Chinese and Indian markets. I would suspect that will have an impact in the sense of energy security when your largest supplier is also going to be supplying significantly to other areas of the world. So from your perspective, from the U.S., I'd really like to hear how you see that whole situation, that whole issue playing out.
Yes, so I'm sorry, could you I'm not sure. I think I understood the context, but the specific issue?
I think the specific issue is that at present we are a provider of a significant amount of oil and uranium into your energy mix in the U.S. That is likely to change and change significantly over the next 20 years. So I would think in the net balance of the energy flows into the U.S., that would be a concern. So rather than try and surmise what that may be, I'm wondering how you perceive Canada's recent announcements about actively pursuing, for example, China as a market, and that the impact that that would have on the flow of both oil and uranium to the U.S. Would impact the sense of security you have around energy.
I see. It's a great question. You know, it shouldn't have surprised anyone to see the Canadian government talk about trying to move its oil to the Pacific from Alberta rather than through Keystone XL to the south, given how uncooperative U.S. officials have been in, you know, helping to bring Canadian energy here. So I think it certainly, if I were in their shoes or in, you know, the oil producer's shoes in that part of Canada, I would certainly be looking westward. It's always nice when you're building pipelines to have multiple paths so that you're not too dependent on one consumer or another. And you can look at the case of Russia and the EU to get a sense for how bad it can be when you're dependent on just one customer. Now, don't get me wrong. I think the United States is far more, the U.S.-Canada relationship is ultimately very productive, and I think the U.S. will, after some initial kind of silliness, figure out a way to make it happen. I also know, as you, I'm sure you do, that there are significant impediments to the actual construction of that pipeline to the sea from the going to the Pacific, and a lot of that is from the First Nations opposition. And so I don't think that that pipeline being built is by any means a foregone conclusion. In fact, I think that just the permitting and legal process could take long enough that you'll see Keystone XL be the more viable and ultimately the adopted solution. What that would do to the oil market, I think would, you know, the oil market is a global market, and so when we talk about global kind of oil prices or supply and demand, whether that Canadian oil is shipped via the Pacific or the Gulf of Mexico is not nearly as important as just the fact that it gets somewhere, so that it could be globally traded. What you have happening right now in North America is, in the U.S. and Canada, so much new oil production that stuff is being, it's causing infrastructure constraints, whether that's on the Canadian side or in Cushing in the mid-continent of the United States. So I don't see it having a huge impact on balances in the short term, but certainly I think governments around the world have an incentive in seeing that, whether it's oil produced in Canada or elsewhere, that's able to get to market to help relieve current supply tightness. I don't have a good answer for you on the uranium issue. It's a great question, but it's not one that I have looked at closely.
Thank you, Blake. Next question, please.
Our next question will come from San Diego State University.
Hi, my question is about sort of what you're talking about Chinese interest in North American oil. Particularly, you're in one of the articles that talked about Cuban oil and Cuban offshore drilling and how that could affect U.S. relations. And is it silly that we still have this embargo with Cuba, and should we be working with them to help them develop their oil infrastructure, as opposed to the threat of a less technologically advanced company coming in and causing an oil spill?
That's a great question. You're right. It's one that I've been looking at closely and that I think policymakers have been kind of increasingly keeping an eye on, and especially down in Florida is, you know, created a fairly hot debate about what we should be doing with Cuban oil production, what we shouldn't. My own sense, and just to give everyone some background on what's going on, private sector geologists basically determined that it appears that Cuba, there's significant offshore oil reserves off the coast of Cuba. They've been talking about the last few years, but private sector oil companies have gotten serious about moving into the Cuban space, and the leasing process has begun just recently. So Repsol, a Spanish-based oil company, has just earlier this year put the first offshore drilling rig off the coast of Havana. It's about, if I'm not mistaken, it's about 70 miles off the coast, the rig itself, of Florida, which raises the question, what would the United States do if there were to be a massive oil spill in Cuban waters? How would we protect U.S. shores? The rig isn't too far, too much further off the coast of Florida than the Deepwater Horizon rig was off the coast of the southern United States. So there's the real possibility that there could be that kind of a spill. Now, we're still, we don't want to get ahead of ourselves in looking at the issue, just because Repsol is still doing exploratory drilling, which means that they have yet to see whether there's actual, the quantity of oil down there that they think there is, but they wouldn't be drilling the rig if they didn't think there was a lot of oil down there to make it worthwhile. So my own feeling on that subject is that it's in U.S. interest to take what I would see as defensive measures to protect the U.S. environment, especially down along the coast of Florida in the case of a spill. And that means very limited, targeted engagement with Cuban officials, in the form of preemptive cooperation and communication in order to help prepare the U.S. Coast Guard and other on-site operators in that region of the country to respond were there to be a spill. So I wouldn't go so far as to say that we should help them. Well, I think it's a very contentious issue, but I think right now, I would say policymakers don't even need to touch kind of the bigger issue of the embargo. What they really necessarily, in order to put some kind of mechanism in place for responding and preparing for a spill, and that should be the first order of business.
Thanks, Blake. Okay, I think we have time for just one more question.
Thank you. Our last question will come from Duke University.
Hi, I think there are two Duke universities. Is this me?
Yes, go ahead.
Thanks. You mentioned the importance of United States regulators supporting domestic oil and gas production. I'm thinking of mostly in petroleum markets. Is that opinion based on sort of an economic benefit to the U.S. from producing more petroleum, or is it more of an energy security issue, whereby we'd see the net imports the United States decreasing over time? And I guess just sort of related to that, if our net imports continue to decline, I'm wondering if you see that as insulating us from global oil market shocks.
Yeah, they're good questions. I think, first off, I think that policymakers should help the oil industry get fracking and other controversial practices right, and get them, get drilling done in the right way. So I think they need to put regulations in place that ensure that, increasing drilling in the United States and some of these new forms of drilling are done in a safe, legal, responsible way. So I think they need to take measures to do that. I also think that, yes, there are some positive implications for both American energy security and the national economy, and the national economy, I should say, from increased oil and gas production. My colleague Michael Levy and I here at the council are going to put out a paper very shortly that talks about exactly these questions, because I think they're very, I think it's a great question in terms of how does domestic oil production, how does it matter for the United States? There are some people who think that it's will solve all our problems, whether it's in terms of energy security or economics. There are others who think that there's nothing desirable about it and that we'd be better off doing away with oil production here at home altogether. And I think I fall somewhere in the middle. But definitely look out for that. I'm sure I'll flag it on our blog at the CFR when the time comes. So because it's a complicated issue that you have to look at, involves things like the current account balance and currency strength and unemployment and short-term versus long-term effects and all those things. So hard for me to get into them right now, but certainly the right question.
We hope to continue this discussion at another time. Blake, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. We covered a lot of ground, and we really appreciate hearing your views. And thanks to all of you around the country and the world for your excellent questions and comments. As you may know, this was the final call of our Winter-Spring 2012 series. Thank you so much for your participation over the course of the semester. We've had some particularly engaging conversations. For the instructors on the call, we will announce the fall 2012 conference call lineup in the upcoming weeks. And for all of you, I look forward to your continued participation in the academic conference call series. Until then, best of luck with finals, and have a wonderful summer.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.